Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Yesterday, North Dakota Governor Jack Dalrymple clarified his emergency evacuation order, saying police will not stop people and supplies from reaching Standing Rock. This is according to the Bismarck Tribune. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers issued a December 5th deadline to vacate the main camp. A statement says, quote, "The Army Corps is seeking a peaceful and orderly transition to a safer location and has no plans for forcible removal, but those who choose to stay do so at their own risk as emergency, fire, medical, and law enforcement response cannot be adequately provided in these areas. Those who remain will be considered unauthorized and may be subject to citation under federal, state, or local laws." North Dakota Governor Dalrymple said his evacuation order will remain in effect even if the Army Corps redefines or removes these prohibited areas. He writes, "These persons are ordered to leave the evacuation area immediately and are further ordered not to return to the area. All persons in the area shall take their possessions with them upon their evacuation." For their part, members of the Standing Rock Sioux and thousands of Native Americans and their allies say they're not going anywhere. They're staying in the middle of a blizzard. It's very cold at the camp. I just read last night that at night, the temperature is below zero. Now, these orders to vacate come a week after law enforcement unleashed water cannons, rubber bullets, pepper spray, and mace in freezing temperatures on individuals trying to stop construction of the $3.8 billion Dakota Access oil pipeline. Dozens of people were seriously injured. On Monday, the Water Protector Legal Collective, those are the lawyers that are representing Native Americans and their allies, sued Morton County, the Morton County Sheriff, Kyle Kirchmeier, and other law enforcement agencies in the U.S. District Court for their alleged use of excessive force against peaceful water protectors. Now, as the December 5th deadline looms, more than 2,000 veterans are making their way to Standing Rock to act as what they call human shields between police and Native Americans on the front lines. So on today's Your Call, we are having a conversation about the latest. What rights do Native Americans have to remain where they are? They say that the land they are on is tribal land. That's according to the 1851 treaty. So what is the status of that treaty today? Joining us is Paul Vandelvelder. He is the author of the Pulitzer Prize-nominated Coyote Warrior, One Man, Three Tribes, and The Trial That Forged a Nation. He's also author of Savages and Scoundrels, the Untold Story of America's Road to Empire Through Indian Country. And Paul has been doing extensive reporting about Standing Rock for High Country News, and you can find his pieces at yourcallradio.org. And Paul joins us from Oregon State University. Hi, Paul. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you, and thank you for your very in-depth reporting. Before we dive in and talk about the legal issues and the treaty, I just want to get your overall take. I mean, so much is going to be happening over the next couple of days. To think about this December 5th deadline and then the 2,000 veterans arriving tomorrow, some say they're going to arrive in their uniforms.
Yeah, it's... I can probably summarize it by saying I spent all day last week, the day before Thanksgiving, Wednesday, on the phone with tribal council members, and they leaked. They basically told me what was coming down. That General Wesley Clark had organized this movement of vets to come to Standing Rock. And I was trying to reach people, various people in the media, and everybody had left for the holiday vacation. And I said, "This is one of the biggest moments in recent American history. I mean, it's as big as it's hard to encapsulate just all the different issues that are wrapped up in this moment. There's so much. This is our national narrative, and people have said, "Oh, you're the Indian writer. You're the guy who writes about Indian issues." And I correct them by saying, "No, I write about American issues. This is the American narrative. If you remove the Native American, if you remove the Black, if you remove the African, if you remove the Latino from the American narrative, what do you have left? Very little."
Hmm. Well, and just to remind everyone, the Dakota Access Oil Pipeline would carry 470,000 gallons of oil per day across four states from North Dakota down to Illinois. Most of the pipeline is complete at this time. What we're looking at here and what's at issue is the permit to go beneath Lake Oahe on the Missouri River. And this is what Native Americans are so angry about and what they're trying to stop, because not only does the water provide drinking, not only does the river provide water for the tribe, but it also provides water for 18 million people. And so that's really what's at issue here.
Well, that it's not only the lake, it also, the pipeline, it also threatens nine tributaries to the Missouri River. Mm. So you have to go back to the legal cases to create the context around which this battle is being fought. And what the tribe is really asserting, and Chase Iron Eyes can jump in at any point when he arrives, they're asserting their reserved rights, which were reaffirmed by the Winters case in 1907. And a reserved right is a very key concept here. It's when a treaty is made between two sovereigns, each sovereign brings, let's say, their rights, their full rights to the bargaining table. And if sovereign A, i.e. the Sioux tribe, is willing to give up its rights B, D, and E, that's in exchange for the rights from the other sovereign to give up X, Y, and Z. So there has to be an agreement. There has to be parity between the two. And in every single treaty in the United States history, every single treaty was requested by the federal government, not by the tribes. Mm. So the rights that are ceded to the federal government, these treaties were a cession of rights from the tribes to the federal government and not the other way around. So reserved rights, the rights that aren't given up are called reserved rights. And the tribes have reserved the right to have clean water, clean air, to be able to feed their people, to be able to organize their society, to conduct their religious ceremonies and their social, you know, their social organizations, to have tribal courts, to have their own self-governing apparatus as a sovereign. So that's what's really on the table here. And the problem that Dalrymple has is that he's not an equal legally to Archambault, the tribal chairman. This has to be resolved between sovereigns. And Mr. Dalrymple, Governor Dalrymple, is not an equal legally to the tribal chairman of the Standing Rock tribe.
Can you talk a little bit more specifically about the 1851 Fort Laramie Treaty? The main camp that was broken down, that was one of the violent crackdowns, so about a month or two ago, was actually called the 1851 Camp. And I'm thinking that a lot of people got sort of Treaty 101. We don't really spend much time talking about treaties. But tell us a little bit about the 1851 Laramie Treaty, because California is actually involved in that.
I think 1851 is one of the most, I called it the Great Smoke at Horse Creek, because what happened when they called the treaty commissioners, David Mitchell and Thomas Fitzpatrick, had appealed to Congress with in 1848-1849 and said, look, we've got a real problem here. They were worried about the welfare of the Indians much more so than the welfare of the pioneers who were heading to Oregon on the Oregon Trail.
And they were also heading to California for the gold rush, right?
They, So they appealed to Congress. Congress came up with the money and approved the Treaty Council. They sent Mitchell and Fitzpatrick sent runners out to the West, not knowing who was going to show up, and said, meet us at Fort Laramie in September, if you possibly can. We need to have a Treaty Council. When they arrived in September, there were 20,000 Native people waiting for them at Fort Laramie, and 50,000 ponies and thousands of teepees. There wasn't a blade of grass, Fitzpatrick said, as far as you could see, because the horses had eaten it all down to nothing. So they moved the Treaty Council to a place called Horse Creek, which was about 30 miles away. And it became known as the Great Smoke. And they spent 3 weeks, the 12 Great Tribes and the Treaty Commissioners, along with the interpreters like Culbertson and Father Pierre de Smet and Jim Bridger, negotiating both their homelands, their areas that would be theirs in perpetuity, and how they were going to conduct relations with the federal government. In the end, the treaty was ratified by the U.S. Senate in 1852, and it recognized those 12 tribes as the owners of a little over 1 million square miles of the West, an area larger than the Louisiana Purchase.
How do you think...
And that was the beginning, in many respects, of the Indian Wars that would go on for the next 35 years.
And Gabriel Galanda is with an Indian country law firm out of Seattle. He says that the treaty defines Sioux treaty territory as running across the Missouri River from the West Bank to the East Bank, including the low water mark down the East Bank. He writes, how then can there not be a legitimate claim to protect the water that runs through reserved ancestral Sioux treaty territory, water that has demarcated the Eastern treaty boundary for 150 years? What are your thoughts on this? Because you've got two very different narratives. The main camp is officially on Army Corps land, but the reservation, Native Americans who are there, say this is treaty land. Paul? Did we lose Paul? Is Paul there? All right. Well, I think now we are joined by Chase Iron Eyes. Chase, are you with us?
Can you hear me?
Is that Chase?
Yes.
Hi. Chase Iron Eyes is a member of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe and a member of the Lakota People's Law Project. He was one of three Native Americans who ran for Congress in North Dakota. Sorry about that, Chase. I think we're having some technical problems. And Paul, are you still...
We're back.
Paul, you're
back.
Okay, great. So, Chase, same question to you. And thank you for joining us, by the way.
Greetings, Chase.
Chase, what are your thoughts on the treaty? Native Americans, members of the Sioux, the Standing Rock Tribe, say that they're on tribal land, treaty land, whereas the government says this is Army Corps land.
Right. Well, I mean, treaties are only as strong as those who are willing to defend them, those who believe in them, those who have a knowledge and a conviction to fight for them. We can scream. We've been screaming for a century that we own the Black Hills, that we deserve to have our treaties honored. But if you notice, the United States court system, which was designed to dehumanize and expropriate from the original landholders of this continent all of their claims, and to keep them in a state of servitude and subjugation. So we, you know what I mean? Like, we can say all we want that we own that land, but unless we're willing to move there and defend our right to be there, the courts will never honor our claims. Not the United States courts, maybe courts of international impact, but we may never get this opportunity in our lifetimes to assert our international personality, our legal rights, our inherent sovereignty to determine our own destiny. That's what's going on right now at this camp. The governor is mobilizing the National Guard. Mm-hmm. The capital city of Bismarck, my friends couldn't even get hotel rooms because first responders and law enforcement have filled them up. They're gearing up for something. Army Corps of Engineers says whoever is there after December 5th is going to be declared trespassers. They keep saying they're not going to raid the camp. That may be so, but I'm a lawyer, but I'm also on the ground. And it's a different situation out here when you hear explosions, when you see your friends, your allies getting shot with rubber bullets. I wasn't there when Sophia Wolanski had her arm blown wide open, but I was there that night. I left about 1:30 in the morning, and that incident happened about 4 in the morning. But I can tell you, you know, look, we are well aware of our treaty rights, and more importantly, our inherent sovereign rights, you know, creator-given rights to determine our own destiny, to be free and independent nations, peoples. How, you know, all of these terms of art that are in international and federal Indian legal lexicon, they all have impact, but none of them, academics, professors, and lawyers in that class of people will just continue to talk about these things unless real people believe in them and are willing to defend these rights.
And Chase, what can you tell us about how this December 5th closure of the camp will be carried out? To let people know, when you write to the Army Corps of Engineers asking for details, they say that because they're in litigation, you have to go to the Department of Justice. So I've been writing the Department of Justice, and they, about a month ago, have been responding, but lately they have not been responding. And then the White House, I'll read a statement from Josh Earnest. The White House press corps finally asked a question about what's happening at Standing Rock, and I'll read that in a couple of minutes. But it seems like we're getting a different message from the Army Corps and the governor of North Dakota. And the Bismarck Tribune just reported that for the third time, North Dakota Emergency Commission members approved $7 million for a line of credit to, quote, cover the ongoing costs of law enforcement response to the Dakota Access Pipeline protests, end quote. So what can you tell us about how this is going to be carried out?
Well, we can't, there's no way to tell really, you know, how they're going to carry it out. But what they're doing is they're exhibiting a willingness to leave no stone unturned, to threaten interstate commerce, to threaten to profile people, to close off the camp by disallowing food, heat, humanitarian aid to be delivered to the camp. The governor has stated that he declared an emergency evacuation and said that the camp needed to be vacated immediately. But he doesn't have the authority to vacate federal property or treaty lands. You know, the Indian Wars never ended. We've been in a state of kind of peaceable relations with respect to the treaty. Some would say, you know, a continued domination and subjugation. You know, I live on the reservation, and there's so many things that are just blatant economic and legal repression that it doesn't have to be this way in 2016. Mm. But unless the governor and the state of North Dakota apparatus know something that we don't, they can't raid. If they get permission from the Army Corps or Obama, not permission, but a request to forcibly remove those who the Army Corps is going to consider trespassers, then a raid is possible. But it's logistically impossible for the camp of 5,000 to 6,000 people to vacate, even if they wanted, if that's all they did from now until December 5th, you know, they may make a dent, but there's 4 feet of snow over already winterized dwellings. I mean, they're not moving, and so It's really tense. There's 2,000 veterans on their way out here. They'll be here in about 72 hours. The governor says one thing and then retracts the force of that statement because he's saying things that he's threatening things that he doesn't have the authority to pull through.
Chase, what can you tell us about the relationship and the communication between the state of North Dakota and the federal government? Yesterday, Chip Reed with CBS News asked Josh Earnest about this. As far as I know, it's the first time that someone from the White House press corps has asked about Standing Rock and what's been happening to Native Americans and their allies being hit with pepper spray, mace, water, and freezing temperatures. And he says, has President Obama done anything to be more involved in this? Josh Earnest said, quote, the president is being regularly updated on the situation. I know there are officials at the White House that have been in touch with agencies, including the Department of Interior. I'm not aware of specific presidential actions that have been taken at this point because the renewed engagement between local populations and the Army Corps. Then he was asked about a possible rerouting of the pipeline, which President Obama suggested the last time he talked about Standing Rock about a month ago. And Josh Earnest said, I think the president's view is that it's in the interests of the tribe, the locally affected tribes, and the Army Corps of Engineers to resolve these differences as soon as possible and let the project go forward. Chase, what's your response to that?
There is no response to that. That's a non-starter. There's no finality or anything in that. I mean, I didn't even know what that means. That means that he's probably going to let things play out, you know, so to speak. But I mean, a reroute would be a victory to the Standing Rock Sioux tribe. It wouldn't be a victory to, you know, a great many people on the ground out there who want pipelines completely done away with or pipelines not crossing major river sources. And so, I mean, the North Dakota government has tried to play this out as a fight against unlawful Indians and their unreasonable wishes to impede progress. They've made claims that Indians are out killing livestock, harassing farmers and ranchers. I mean, it sounds like something out of a dime novel from the late 1800s. And with Obama, I don't, you know, he's just continuing to stall, and I don't know why. I don't know at what level he's communicating with the state of North Dakota, but I don't think it's in depth, because the state of North Dakota hates Obama. They try to they're one of those people that object to Obama's agenda, just on principle. The Republican dominated legislators in this state do that, and so what I'm noticing is that they're trying to blame Obama. They're trying to blame the Army Corps of Engineers for all of this whole happening, and they're using every measure of, you know, state power. They're trying to test the limits of state power. For instance, in control of the National Guard, in activating the National Guard, the governor of this state can do that in times of peace. But in times of conflict, in times of emergencies or great incidents, the President of the United States has the authority to commandeer, operations of North Dakota's National Guard. So, I mean, it's a small state. I have friends. I know that a lot of the National Guard is already mobilized, and they're gearing up for something. Either they know something we don't. They know that Obama or the Army Corps is going to allow drilling under the river and violate our treaty. I mean, we don't even talk about the subsurface or the mineral rights in relation to the treaty. All we talk about is the surface rights. And I mean, as a practical matter, I don't ever say we want to disturb private property interests. I mean, that's an issue that private property owners need to take up with the person who purported to grant them, you know, title in that land. But our struggle, our fight is with the United States. We predate the existence of the United States and of the state of North Dakota. But they've been militarily and economically, politically, and legally oppressing tribal nations. But we just live in this reality. We're born into it, and we think this is normal, but it's not.
Chase, before we let you go, what is next for the movement? We were talking about the fact that it's freezing there at night. It's below zero. Again, Native Americans, their allies, say they're not going anywhere, and the vets are expected to arrive tomorrow. Actually, many vets have arrived today. But what's next?
We're going to have to, what's next is to use unarmed and nonviolent measures to stop the pipeline. But in that process, we need to make our claims related to our international character and personality, the rights that we have as Native nations vis-a-vis the United States and the world community, because we may never get this opportunity again. Mm.
Chase Iron Eyes is a lawyer and a member of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. He was one of three Native Americans who ran for Congress in North Dakota. Thank you for joining us, Chase, and we'd love to have you back in the coming months.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And coming up after the break, we'll continue our discussion with Paul Van Develder, who is the author of Savages and Scoundrels, The Untold Story of America's Road to Empire Through Indian Territory. Check out Paul's reporting. He's been doing in-depth reporting for High Country News. You can find that at yourcallradio.org. Today we are getting the latest from Standing Rock. What's happening right now is the Army Corps of Engineers has issued a December 5th eviction notice for thousands of Native Americans and their allies who are camping on the banks of the Missouri River. In North Dakota, 2,000 veterans are expected to arrive at Standing Rock tomorrow. They say they're going to stand in between police and people on the front line. Some say they plan to wear their uniforms. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
There are many ways you can take part in the conversation on Your Call. You can go on the telephone. You can send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. You may go to the yourcallradio.org website. You can also tweet us at Your Call Radio. Our telephone number, toll-free, is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. We'll discuss media coverage of the ongoing ground and air assault on eastern Aleppo. We'll also look at how the media covered the legacy of Cuban leader Fidel Castro. That's tomorrow. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are continuing our coverage of Standing Rock. Tomorrow, 2,000 veterans are expected to arrive, and then the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has issued a December 5th deadline to vacate the main camp. And we're joined today by Paul Van Develder. He is the author of Savages and Scoundrels, The Untold Story of America's Road to Empire Through Indian Territory. He's also been writing lengthy pieces about Standing Rock for High Country News. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Paul, you've been covering this very closely. President Obama has only spoken about Standing Rock twice when he was asked questions about it. What did you think of Josh Earnest's response when he said these issues need to be resolved as soon as possible and, quote, let the project go forward?
I couldn't agree more. I couldn't agree with Chase more on that. It was just government doublespeak. It was utterly meaningless rhetoric. I like many people, are very baffled by the Obama administration's reaction and how they've handled this entire situation. It is a sovereign-to-sovereign issue that has to be resolved between the two sovereigns, and North Dakota is not one of those sovereigns. North Dakota is a minor player in this, and yet it's been the antagonist right from the very beginning. So there was a brief moment of hope when the Army Corps of Engineers and the Department of Justice issued a joint press release halting the pipeline, the building of the pipeline, until further studies could be done. And also reminding everyone that the right of assembly was guaranteed in the Bill of Rights to the Constitution. What Chase didn't mention as well is, and this is the part that seriously baffles me, treaties are protected under Article 6, Clause 2 of the Constitution as the supreme law of the land. Let me repeat that. The supreme law of the land. Nothing can trump a treaty. Otherwise, all relations, all negotiations with foreign powers would be meaningless. It's a standard, it's just a standard construct in international law. So why the treaty has been so severely, so severely undermined is completely baffling to me. And we come back to John Adams' statement that we are a country of laws, not of men. But then where is all this lawlessness being? Where does the lawlessness come into that equation? How are we allowing the lawlessness that we've seen here at Standing Rock to control the discussion between those two sovereigns? Obama has a full responsibility to step forward and deal with this, and he's not doing it. And Governor Dalrymple is not in a legal position. He doesn't have the legal standing to deal with it. From the point of view that, first of all, the water that's flowing down the Missouri River is federal water. It's not owned by the state. And it's also protected by the tribe under their reserved rights, which Chase was referring to, although he didn't call it reserved rights. It's their right to a livelihood. And part of that right, according to the Supreme Court, is clean water and clean air and the right to feed and clothe the people in their society and have their own tribal courts.
Humboldt has some really good information about the 1851 Fort Laramie Treaty. And according to this really nice website, the U.S. government violated the 1851 treaty the very next year in 1852.
They did. At the same year they ratified it. See, here was the problem. Here's what happened. When Thomas Jefferson, you have to go back about 50 years, and I'll try to make this quick. Thomas Jefferson was having trouble selling the quote-unquote Louisiana Purchase to Congress for $15 million. So to sweeten the deal, he changed the name of it and called it the Louisiana Purchase, when in fact it was an annex. The treaty itself with France says that the Indian tribes remain the titled owners to all of Louisiana, all of France's territory. So when Congress found itself in a big debate over slavery in the Kansas-Nebraska Act 50 years later, the Commissioner of Indian Affairs, William Medill, was invited to Congress, and he said, "Hey, you guys, you got a serious problem here. Your discussion, your debate is moot because you don't even own the land. The Indians own the land." And Congress said, "What are you talking about?" And he said, "Read the treaty." So they looked at the treaty and they realized he was right. The Indians still owned the land. That's why we were compelled as a sovereign nation to negotiate all these treaties with Indian tribes in order to acquire public domain, because we didn't own it. So the 1851 treaty guaranteed the tribes their homelands, which was about a million square miles of land in the West. And then in 1852, the federal government turned right around, ignored the agreements it had made, and that began the dismantling of that treaty, which brought us down to 1868, when Red Cloud refused to meet with General Sherman. And I think it bears noting that when General Sherman years later was done, the Indian Wars were over, he was back in D.C., and he was asked by a group of reporters, "Could you please explain to us what this whole idea of an Indian reservation is?" And General Sherman said, "I'm glad you asked that question. An Indian reservation is a parcel of land that's set aside for the exclusive use of the Indians, surrounded by thieves." And, you know, I mean, and I thought that was an extraordinary comment from General Sherman, who had been, you know, ordered to conduct the Indian Wars through the 60s and 70s. He came back, and General Harney, like Douglas MacArthur, met with Congress when he retired after spending 50 years in the Indian Wars. And he told Congress, "I have never been involved in an altercation with the Indian tribes, and I know of no conflict or battle in which the Indians were in the wrong."
Wow. Paul Van Develder is the author of Savages and Scoundrels, The Untold Story of America's Road to Empire Through Indian Territory. His latest piece for High Country News is Reckoning at Standing Rock. "Want to understand the pipeline protests? Start with the Founding Fathers," he writes. Find his reporting at yourcallradio.org. It's a really interesting piece with a lot of history, very extensive. Now I would like to welcome Stephanie Soce to the show. Stephanie is an associate attorney with Earth Justice and is one of the attorneys representing the Standing Rock Sioux tribe. She's an enrolled member of the Navajo Nation. Hi, Stephanie. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thank you.
I wanted to ask you about legal grounds. We've been talking about this December 5th deadline. The Army Corps set this deadline. They want people to evacuate the camp. They say they're not going to forcibly remove people, but they might be arrested. What legal grounds does the Army Corps of Engineers have to force people to leave?
Well, you know, the Army Corps does have the whole... The reason why we're suing the Army Corps in D.C. is that they do have jurisdiction over those lands. So in terms of what the Army Corps can do to make protectors leave, that's not something that we're working on in our case. You know, we're focusing on the National Historic Preservation Act claims and the National Environmental Policy Act claims. However, I find the statement itself appalling that the Army Corps would try and exercise any of this jurisdiction. So,
what can they legally do at this point? It seems like we're getting different messages from the Army Corps and the North Dakota state government. In fact, the sheriff's office has complained many times that the federal government isn't doing more to assist them.
So the question is, what can the Army Corps do legally?
At this point, we've seen water cannons, rubber bullets, pepper spray, mace. Do you expect that to continue? As far as I know, for the first time, the Water Protector Legal Collective, these are the lawyers that are representing Native Americans and their allies, sued Morton County and the sheriff for their alleged use of excessive force. I mean, do you think that this is going to continue on December 5th? This is what everyone's been asking.
I honestly couldn't tell you. I am really hopeful that the governor of North Dakota steps down in you know his proclamation that people would be evicted. I also am very hopeful and call on the Obama administration to step in. Obviously, his previous statement to let this sort of play out hasn't really worked out very well. So I remain, you know, hopeful that nothing terrible will happen on December 5th, but at the same time, I really think that the administration needs to step in and take action.
Stephanie, what can the administration do at this point? Yesterday, Press Secretary Josh Earnest said he wants different parties to get together, resolve their differences as soon as possible, and, quote, let the project go forward.
Yes. So that, I mean, that was incredibly disheartening. But right now, the Army Corps still has not issued the easement to drill under Lake Oahe. In the case that they were to deny that easement, which is what we're hoping the administration does, that they have that they do the right thing and deny the easement, that would stop construction. And you know, that's part of the whole contention in this case. We've also been aware of a number of members of a number of representatives who have called on the Department of Justice to investigate the actions of the Morton County Sheriff's Department, and so far that has not; those requests have not been heeded.
Right. Letters have been sent to Attorney General Loretta Lynch, but when you call the AG, you have to go through the DOJ, and it seems like they're not really giving many statements right now. And Stephanie, in terms of rerouting the pipeline, we're talking about the part of the pipeline that goes under Lake Oahe. The majority of the pipeline is already completed. In fact, construction is happening nonstop. If you're at the camp, you see these very bright lights that are on the construction area. Crews are being brought in. The pipeline is essentially being protected by police and military vehicles. So people at the camp, Native Americans and their allies, can no longer access that part of the pipeline because it's being blocked, essentially protected. How could the pipeline be rerouted at this point, considering that most of it has been completed?
I think that Dakota Access is relying on that argument. They took a huge gamble with investor money and started building a multi-billion dollar pipeline before it had all of the federal permits that it needed. And so when we're talking about a reroute and asking the question of how can it be rerouted, that question wasn't even asked in the first place before they started the construction. So, I understand the practicality since most of the pipeline is already built, but that's the argument that the pipeline company would rely on, and I can't accept that.
And Paul, what do you think?
Oh, I agree. I think it's this is history repeating itself. When the Pix Loan Plan was passed by Congress in 1944 as part of the Flood Control Act, ironically, once again, the Army Corps of Engineers looked at the river and placed the dams, the flood control dams like Oahe and Garrison, at spots that would flood and inundate Indian-owned land and leave white towns and white lands intact. Mm. That came up, of course. It ended up being an unconstitutional taking of Indian lands that Congress had to swallow that one in 1992 and awarded both the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara tribes and the Standing Rock tribes monies to compensate them for that. But what happened, here's the interesting thing. The Army Corps went through the process and motions when they relocated all the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara people to build Garrison Dam, but it took years. So when they got to Standing Rock, they didn't even bother going through the process. They just gave everybody a day to move out, and then they literally bulldozed their homes or torched them, wow, burned them down. There are a lot of people at Standing Rock who still remember that happening. Mm-hmm. And it's so when you look at the pipeline and you say where could it go, they're going to have to find an alternative for it, and it's going to be expensive, but they played their cards. And the Army Corps right now, I think, is probably just hoping some kind of miracle happens between now and a moment of reckoning. But clearly, the pipeline, it's also a question of environmental racism, et cetera, because if you reroute the pipeline to avoid the white town and then run it through Indian lands, what are you saying? What is that statement?
Which is what happened, because the original route was supposed to go north of Bismarck, which is 90% white. And then people were afraid that there would be a leak, and then it was rerouted.
Sure. And Garrison Dam was placed so that it wouldn't flood Williston. It could very easily have been placed upstream about 40 miles, and it would have spared the 156,000 acres of Indian land that were inundated. But they didn't. They put it where it is, and the Indians lost all of their, they'd been there for 1,000 years. They were completely self-sustaining. They didn't need a dime from the federal government, but then they lost their ability to grow their food and sustain their way of life when Garrison Dam was built and Williston was spared.
Let's take a caller who has a question about public health. Let's go to George in San Francisco. Hi, George.
Okay, that's very important, the fact that there were treaties violated in the past. Maybe they did or didn't have a fallback plan. But now what this could be is just a pipeline to nowhere. It could be that these are the death throes of an industry that's been outlived. We're thinking that oil and coal would possibly be in their death throes. But when we think about oil in the river, let's specifically look forward. Who does that affect? It affects millions of people who depend on that water for their drinking supplies. And it also affects the agricultural and industrial applications that are downriver. So our question that we started out to seek an answer for is, what happens when there's a spill? Does that not only mean no drinking water, but possibly all the generating stations have to go offline, so it means lights out because they can't use the water for their cooling towers?
Well, what about that, Stephanie?
Could I jump?
Oh, sure. Paul, go first.
Good. That is an absolutely excellent question, and the reason I say that is because in 1932, Congress asked the Army Corps of Engineers to come up with a report on the Missouri River. General Lytle Brown presented to Congress a 1,200-page study of the Missouri River, and they recommended that under no circumstances should the federal government consider damming the Missouri River above Sioux City, Iowa, because it would forever be dealing with the siltation problems. They ignored that 12 years later and passed the Flood Control Act of 1944. What that resulted in downstream, and this goes exactly to what the caller was referring to, downstream in the 1960s, hydrologists and wildlife biologists began noticing that all the barrier islands were disappearing in the Gulf of Mexico just off the coast of Louisiana, the very barrier islands that protected the city of New Orleans. By 1990, they were gone. And they were gone because the silts that had been feeding those islands for thousands of years were trapped behind the dams on the Missouri River. And sure enough, General Lytle Brown's prediction came true when Hurricane Katrina came ashore. Mm. Well, the very same thing is going to happen with oil. It's going to have the same kinds of unpredictable, unforeseeable effects if and when that pipeline breaks.
Stephanie, what would you add?
I would echo that. You know, we unfortunately have seen pipeline leaks in rivers. We've seen a pipeline leak in the Kalamazoo River recently, and the effects on not just the water quality, but on fish and wildlife, depending on the severity of the leak, can be catastrophic. And we've seen time and time again that oil spills don't really fully get cleaned up. In this case, the detection mechanism is iffy at best, so it could leak very slowly for a very long time before it's caught.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for the call. We have an email from Augusta, and Paul, you touched on this earlier, but Augusta writes, the only reason that the land next to the lake, quote, belongs to the Army Corps of Engineers is that they violated the treaty by taking it over after the dam was built. Can you please elaborate on that?
Absolutely. That's exactly right. And Chase Iron Eyes referred to it earlier. This is just talking about the surface. They may have illegally taken the land that was, that was guaranteed, was treaty protected by the 1851 treaty, but they didn't take the mineral rights or the subsurface rights, and those are still owned by the tribes. Martin Cross, the tribal chairman of the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara, spent the 1950s fighting to maintain the mineral rights for his tribes and the tribes downstream. He was also the vice president for the National Congress of American Indians, and he got those rights secured. So even though the Army Corps may technically have it, we have to understand that they're also holding that land in trust for the tribes. And this is something that very few people are bringing up or talking about. The federal government has a trustee-guarantor relationship with the tribes. And even though they took the land to build Lake Oahe, they still the tribes still never ceded that land, and the federal government technically is still a guarantor to the tribes and responsible with a fiduciary obligation to safeguard those lands. So that's why this becomes so convoluted and difficult to understand how and why the federal government has been acting the way it has been.
Hmm. We have about a minute left. Paul, where do you see this going? What's next?
Well, you know, I can say I spent 2.5 hours behind a closed door with the Chief Justice of the North Dakota Supreme Court when I was out there in September. He was one of my deep throats for Coyote Warrior, a fine man, a wonderful man. And we spent 2.5 hours discussing the finer points of the jurisdictional issues that seem to all converge here. I don't see how this cannot land and finally end up in the courts and be resolved by the courts. It's not going to be resolved by the politicians. They're completely useless. Mm-hmm. The state courts have no jurisdiction here. The federal courts eventually will have to step in, and it'll be with Stephanie's lawsuit, the lawsuit brought by her organization or various other ones. I'm waiting for NARF to jump in, the Native American Rights Fund out of Boulder, Colorado. They could tie the courts up for a long time with this, and it's not going to be resolved on December 5th. I can guarantee you that.
And Stephanie, 30 seconds. What would you add? Where do you see this going?
You know, we implore again on the administration. You know, the Obama administration has made a commitment to Native Americans, and now this is his time to fulfill that promise.
Correct.
That he made. And I agree there will be no resolution on the 5th, but the lawsuit will go forward. The Native American Rights Fund is involved in our lawsuit to some capacity, and so, you know, we will continue advocating on behalf of the tribe.
Stephanie Soucy is Associate Attorney at Earth Justice, one of the lawyers representing the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe in their lawsuit against the Army Corps of Engineers. She's an enrolled member of the Navajo Nation. And Paul Van Delvelder is author of Savages and Scoundrels, The Untold Story of America's Road to Empire Through Indian Country. Check out his in-depth reporting about Standing Rock at High Country News. Stephanie and Paul, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
Thank you so much, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss coverage of the ongoing ground and air assault on eastern Aleppo by Russia, the Syrian regime, and its regional allies. We'll also look at how the media covered the legacy of Cuban revolutionary leader Fidel Castro. Who was he, and how should he be remembered? Email your questions and comments to feedback@yourcallradio.org, and join us live at 10 a.m. with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.